Good afternoon to everyone. Good afternoon to those investors and analysts on the line. Apologies for being a few minutes late. We do apologize. We've got a room full of people here in Johannesburg and about 20 people or so on the telephone line. As the program indicated, for the next few minutes, the next hour, the divisional CEOs for services, financial services and automotive will take us through their business update. The training update has been released on SENSE. It's sort of about 15, 20 minutes on each division. For some of them, we will show you some interesting videos just to break the program up a bit. So first in line is Alan Feynman, the CEO of Services, our biggest division. Alan, over to you.
Thank you, Ilse. I don't think there's any reason to talk about the economy. You all know what's happening, and we don't actually look at it. So what I can tell you is that overall we are very pleased with where we are. We do have some pockets of issues, primarily in the travel space, which is similar to what we had in the previous 2 years. It is a disrupted industry and there's tremendous down trading. So for me, that's the one big negative in the division. It's not massively relevant to the numbers, though, I must be honest. What is happening there is we are well into the implementation of different technologies from global suppliers, which is what I think we indicated last year. It does take quite a lot of time. We merged some businesses. There were some developments with HRG, which you might have seen, in that they were bought out effectively by Amex. So we will be merging our HRG, which was Rennie's, in with BCD, which actually is very positive for our business, and it'll speed up some synergies. So it's actually worked out quite well for us. In terms of some of the other bigger sides of the division, in the FM space, the FM and integrated FM market is actually very buoyant. There's a lot of what is called first generation type of contracts that are in negotiation stages at various points. So there is that trend, which is a global trend. We are seeing a lot of desire to merge services and get the benefits of an integrated FM. It is very positive for us. We are the biggest in terms of hard services, self-servicing, and we obviously have all the self-service, soft-service businesses, which are our own. And that's really a global trend, is that you're getting the sort of middleman being washed out, and if you can't self-service, you can't really compete. So it's particularly good for us. We're winning certainly more than our market share, and there are one or two big ones that are currently in the space, which will come to fruition probably late in 2020. But those deals do take a long time. So it's very buoyant, and that business is doing particularly well. Some of the other bigger businesses, Prestige, that's had a difficult time for the last year, has turned around very nicely. They've secured a very, very large contract in January, and we continue to see their turnaround progressing. And similar with all the annuity income businesses, if your pipeline is good and you've secured the business early on, it really does build a very nice base for the next year. So we're very pleased with them. Our security businesses, of which Protea is obviously the biggest, have definitely outperformed the market. The desire for security service that is a guard at the gate, I think, is gone. So a lot of the smaller guys are feeling tremendous pressure. You've got to be able to deliver a service outside of simply a guard at a booth. And that really is Protea's game. They've got a whole range of diverse security services. So they've done very well. In the mid-air space, it's quite buoyant. We have got a new extension to the license of another 3 years. We've renewed all our lounges for at least another 5 years. We're obviously revamping one or two of the big ones at ORT in particular. And that space is growing. In fact, if we could have more space from AXA, we really would grab it. Probably what is a little bit concerning in that area is obviously whatever's happening with SAA. It doesn't impact on us tremendously, but we don't really do much with SAA, but we do a lot with Mango. And Mango's turns, actually, which is the real number of flights and how you turn it, is actually declining because they don't have enough capacity. So that's a bit concerning. We don't know if it's short term or medium term. I don't think they know either. But generally, that space is very good. One of our biggest businesses is obviously our hygiene business. They're doing well. They're certainly exceeding inflation. But there's no real big revenue growth in this year in that space, simply in that people haven't really gone to tend on big sites. There were one or two of late. We won both of them, and they would come into play in the next financial year. So there's a little bit of consolidation happening where people were putting their services out on a regional basis. That seems to be moving away. They're looking for leverage. They're looking for benefits. We're obviously a national player, so we do expect to pick up some of that business, which we have done. In the smaller part of the business, which is Allied, you obviously saw Aquazania, most of you. It's a very exciting business. We've had it since February. We're obviously going to merge it, and you saw part of the merge. We're really very early stages with the merge. They've got a very, very sophisticated and clever IT system that drives the heart of the business. And for the 4 or 5 odd months that we'll have it by June, they're certainly exceeding expectations. I think that's probably the bulk of the big businesses in the division. From an acquisition perspective, let me talk about Noonan. We do have Noonan. Noonan's doing exceedingly well.
He's got an Irish passport now.
Noonan's doing very well in hard currency. They're growing in Ireland. Their cleaning business in the UK is doing particularly well as well. We've got a new MD who started last week for the security business. We've had some challenges in that security space in the UK. And that's simply around the change in spec that you're seeing in central London. I think the threat of terrorism, although it hasn't gone, a lot of the clients are looking for a more softer hospitality type approach to security, which we need to adapt to. So that space is a little bit tricky, but it's still doing fine. The UK economy generally is very challenging, very competitive, and we obviously need some resolution to their political impasse. From an acquisition perspective, we are continuously looking in the UK and other territories, both for Noonan and for some of our other stated strategic objectives like hygiene. We've got one or two things on the go. We've always got at least one or two things on the go. But it's not easy to do a deal in the UK. We have to do a deal at the right price. So it's not easy. Believe it or not, people have pushed their price up with Brexit. They haven't brought it down. So it's very competitive in that space. In South Africa, we've obviously bought ClickOn, which we did talk about at the half year, which falls into our security guys. It's an estate access management business. It's doing very nicely. Aquazania is in from February, and they're doing way better than expectations. We have bought a drone business called UDS. I think for many of us around the table, the most exciting, innovative disruptor we've seen. They've only run it for about 3 years. It makes a fair amount of money. It's not a startup that makes nothing. It makes good money. It's going to grow continuously. We're first to market. The deal's done. We are just waiting for a transfer of a license through civil aviation. It will disrupt security, and it will disrupt the industrial inspection space. It's got a place in the insurance area. Maybe if we show you the video, you'll have an idea around what they do. We can then take some questions on either them or anything on the division.
You want to show the video first,
I think it's easier to explain.
This one here just goes, that Click On business was a very nice, innovative new business, market leader in access control for space, you know, with all those scanning devices or PIN numbers, etc. That's exactly what it does, and it has current how many estates?
Excess of 200 estates.
And most of the really big ones.
Same city
type of.
And is it an annuity type business? They pay you monthly to use the system.
They pay per, depending on, there's different options. Sometimes you pay per visitor, you buy a bundle of 20 or 100, you pay per click, basically. We've launched an app. Since we bought it, we've developed an app for it, which will make it a lot easier for the user, and very transparent for homeowners. It's a very nice annuity income business.
I think yours is ready now.
Okay.
Being in the driver's seat is not your usual job. We do have a very cool job. What we like about the business is, on paper, it shouldn't be possible. You shouldn't be able to fly drones at night 25 kilometers in controlled airspace. Here is a spotted under the orbit of the Xbox of Action. An NGO involved in nature conservation and in counter-poaching initiatives. They asked us if we could develop the skills in using our passive drone technology to help in the fight against wildlife crime. And they gave us the initial funding. We then went to Kruger National Park. We started flying there, always having at the back of our minds the commercial aspect of it. We developed very special skills in that, which were very important in retrospect. We were allowed to really do whatever we wanted to in flying these aircraft. We became very good at that game, and that is we are way ahead of the other competitors, especially flying at night time. So we perfected that in the Kruger National Park, and we brought that into the commercial aspect of the business. And that is where our success has been. Regulations arrived and then they actually grounded us and said that we had to comply with the then civil aviation rules applying to drones. We were very lucky with South Africa's approach in the beginning. They made it so difficult. They were the first in the world to have regulations like we have today. The importance is that they treated us as an airline, so we are no different from any commercial airline anywhere in the world. So I was the first person to be interviewed by this board, and they didn't really even know what to ask me. I gave them the story about what we're doing in Kruger National Park and how it could make a difference, and they awarded what the first air services license in the country, and it's probably in the world at the time. Our license was particularly unique because we were flying at night in drone terms beyond the visual line of sight.
Nobody was getting a license today in South Africa besides UDS. To fly 25 kilometers away.
In the US, for instance, they have done very few beyond visual line of sight nighttime flights. They buy exemption, and usually in Alaska and those kind of places. Nowhere in the world does an operation like ours, where it's flying in the metropolitan city, 1 kilometer away from an international airport, lights off, and we see no radar. There's nothing that looks like that anywhere in the world.
We had quite a high profile at that stage on television, and we had a call from commercial clients saying that they'd seen these programs and they were quite interested in developing the technology in the commercial space. We were instantly successful. They used to employ 120 extra guards to try and defend a 26-kilometer perimeter. We reduced the crime down to 2% of what it used to be. We reduced the guards down to 8. The security budget is now 30% of what it used to be. The most significant industry that I think will disrupt is the security industry. We've seen in every site that we've gone to that we've had a major effect instantly. We use thermal cameras on our planes, and we then relay that live image back to our command and control vehicle. We're able to give instant imagery and intelligence back to security people on the ground, and that's been the big game changer. Once the guys see what the drones can do, and what it can do to their lives and to their security, then they never ever go back to the traditional security. The other industry that we are disrupting is the survey business. This has been the domain of surveyors using ground-based technology. We've been able to deliver survey results highly accurate. The other industry is engineering inspections, where traditionally you would have to use all sorts of very dangerous ways of inspecting high-value infrastructure.
On the industrial side, we have all the little big silos. We used to take about a week to build all the scaffolding, and today we can do a job that used to take a week. It can take virtually 10 minutes to inspect all these silos inside and outside.
We develop most of our aircraft, so they're purpose-built for our lifetime surveillance operations. We have a fixed-wing aircraft, which is called the Battle, which we've flown probably about 60,000 hours on that type of airframe. There are other interesting developments that we've been asked to do by clients. Flying underground is a very interesting mining application, where they have asked us to go where they don't want to put humans. So we would fly a drone in a cage that bounces off the walls and can roll it on the ground and, you know, get to places where they don't particularly want people.
We designed this drone to use for operations for like pipes or mines or places where the drone can get damaged, where you can't actually retrieve it. The cage prevents the drone from getting too damaged, therefore you can still fly back. It's on the gyro, so it always stays level, doesn't matter which way it gets hit.
Robert is a technical guy. He's really been the engine behind the innovation of the drones. People are looking at these things and saying they work so well, they're relatively inexpensive than what we now want them. They're reliable and we've got the recipe right. They want to hire these services to either do 3D photogrammetry for stockpile management, to just do surveillance work. The list is just endless. It goes on and on and on. And the fact that we have a workshop like this is what really allows that operation to happen. Without this kind of infrastructure and setup and this knowledge, that doesn't happen very easily or affordably.
The art in our business is to take existing technologies and integrate them on a cost-effective basis.
It's quite interesting because you build a drone from scratch and then you spit it up and you go out just like to see the end product and make you want to allow one of the job.
Yes, we employ about 100 people and we have 80 pilots now that are fully operational.
We have now invested in the training school. We are going to be accelerating on the training of these pilots to 20 or 30 at a time to basically cater for the demand that we see. There's no substitute for time and experience.
We have set the bar very, very high.
The 10,000 hour rule, we've got 6 of those. I don't think any competitor of ours in this country has even got the 10,000 hours.
We make sure day and night that we put daylight between us and them.
We're always going to be pushing the envelope to try and fly longer, carry bigger, heavier payloads, do more things with the craft, so it's never going to stop. It's an ongoing cycle.
Why don't you embrace the technology and work with us? You can only find success.
I mean, the key obviously is the beyond visual line of sight. They're the only ones in the country. To get it would take someone at least another 4 years. It took them years and years to build up the hours in the Kruger. And As you heard, they've got 80 pilots. They do, the pilots take 9 months at a time.
Interesting, that's not a drone pilot. That's a proper qualified pilot.
Yeah.
So you become a pilot before you become a drone pilot.
Yeah. You become a pilot first, and then we these guys have recruited them from SIA or Mango or whatever. Proper pilots.
Yeah. So in Cape Town, which is what he's referring to, we take off under the control of the Cape Town Airport. So the drones have got radar detectors on the system. Pilots coming in can see them. So we do a lot of work there for PRASA. In areas where it's very difficult to have success with guards and it's dangerous. They do a lot of work with Transnet, with the mining groups. Their success rate on curbing losses is, in some cases, it's 90%. That one big site they showed you, I can't really tell you who it is. I mean, the losses have dropped 90%. And they've got one team, one reaction team at night. I think you saw it. Sometimes the reaction team is with dogs. The thermal imaging is picking up people moving around. The faster you run, the more you blow.
So if you want to outpost it, go slow.
Yeah. They drop a pin, and the reaction unit team just arrives. So it's really, really very cost-effective. It's a win for everyone. Makes money. We think we can do a lot with it, obviously, within our space and in other areas that we're not in.
And at the moment, these all have to be manned, so you can't have them autonomously flying a circular route around them.
They're not manned. There's no pilot sitting in that little thing.
No, but I'd be sitting in the truck on the ground.
Yeah.
No, they're all manned.
They're all manned.
Because they need to be proactive. You see something, it needs to hover. You know, et cetera, et cetera. Or you might want to go right or left. So this guy's looking on a big screen in his control vehicle, and he detects what he thinks is something. It might be a, I don't know if there's a difference, so they can detect animals to humans, et cetera.
They glow differently.
But he needs to be able to maneuver and hover and whatever.
Yeah.
That's why you need a highly qualified pilot.
Lights on, lights off, different heights.
Sounds like it's very far off the crime trend.
I think it's going to change a lot of the big loss-making areas. Transnet's a good example with container depots.
Big mining. The cable theft on mines is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it does, it's not just the cable theft, then brings the mine to a halt for a while, you know, until they can replace that cable.
Yeah.
The big cable theft happens on mines, not just in municipalities.
Yeah. They've been asked to fly in central Joburg now, with the M2 being under repair. There's a huge influx of traffic, and there's been a huge influx of crime. And you obviously got the banks there. Mm-hmm. So the banks have asked us to put a system together to fly and work with their teams, because it's problematic for their staff. So there's numerous opportunities just in our space, but outside of that, it's, as he says, the sky is the limit with this business. Very exciting business.
Can you perhaps give us an idea of the size of the business and the nature of the pricing or contracting model? How does that work with your clients?
We can't really tell you the size of the business. Did we disclose what you pay for?
No, we didn't.
No, you'll get that information next final.
Final will get
you.
And the contracting model, longer-term contract, short-term contract, ad hoc?
They work off everything. No contract. Contracts, it's really up to the clients. They're not fussed.
Look, we've just bought it. We may have to professionalise that a little bit. You know, it does worry me a little bit when I heard that. Clearly, you know, our traditional model is a term contract, you know, renewable, and we'll get to that. These are the three entrepreneurs, those guys that were actually in the video, the two guys, the mafia act and the other act and whatever, but they're proper entrepreneurs. We've signed them all up. They're all staying with the business.
Yeah.
They operate out of a really nice little cave. I've seen Parkhurst somewhere, isn't it?
No, they've moved now.
They've moved.
Dunkeld.
Yeah. So we will do a few things. But the margins, all I can tell you, the margins are unbelievably good. The pricing model is variable. So it really is a cost-saving model. Mm-hmm. So if the guy, like he said, at the one site they had, it was 300 girls, he said, and it's down to 8.
Yeah, 120.
He's now charging a 30%. It reduced the security cost down, I think he said, to 30% of what it was.
Mm.
And that's what he's charging. So I can't really give you the detail, but you imagine having a team of 2 pilots, 1 drone, flying around. It's not that expensive.
Yeah.
Alan, how big is the security cluster now within services, roughly?
Compared to what? To the total?
Yeah.
We don't seem to know the odds.
I do know the odds.
Like a quarter, a third.
It's probably 30%. Maybe a little bit more.
Once this kicks in.
When this is in and Clickon's in fully.
So when you have a look at the cluster as a whole,
yeah,
all our people, and you think about it in 3 years' time, is the general mix of the businesses in terms of hygiene, services, air, security, where do you think the growth areas are going to be? And
I think the growth area for us, hygiene always, because you always need it. So you'll get growth everywhere. The FM business of ours will bring a lot of growth that some of our businesses were locked out of in the past, because of what they can do with bundling and everything. So FM will drive a lot of the growth within that cluster, which includes a lot of the softer services that sits in Allied, water, coffee, plants, etc. And then I'm not convinced that there's tremendous growth in air, unless there's changes in capacity within the AXA environments. You need bigger spaces, you need more lounges, we need more landing spaces. So there's certainly growth there, but I think the real growth will come in FM and security in South Africa, in that combined pieces.
The way that we actually manage and look at these businesses within Allan, because it's a massive division, including Noonan. The FM cluster, it's actually a cluster, so it's facility management, it's cleaning, hygiene,
and catering.
That's one cluster of business. So when Alan refers to it, he's talking about all of those.
Yeah.
But there's a cross-pollination. So he would have a group sales director, for a better word, who sells across all of the aspects of the business. So she would sell, it happens to be a she, would sell that FM cluster, as it is, but she would add to that security, she would add coffee, water, landscaping,
yeah,
laundries, whatever the guy might require.
And just generally, when you have a look at the pricing that you're able to get through, it's quite difficult, I would imagine. Are you at least getting enough pricing through across the businesses to offset the cost push that you're having?
Yes. The margins haven't dropped. In many cases, they've actually gone up.
And that's
not just by pushing the price up to clients, because there's a resistance.
Yeah. And that's at the gross margin, isn't it?
Yeah.
When we talk margin, we talk gross margin, core OPEX. But that's the real margin that you have to look at. Because sometimes it's quite easy to save OPEX, you know, which we obviously push all the time.
Sure.
But that GP, what we call a GP, is absolutely vital, because that's where he has to get his cost recoveries and better efficiencies.
And you're getting enough on the GP line to offset the OPEX pressure?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, the net margin also hasn't declined, not in his business.
No.
Alan will join us over lunch as well, so if there's any last bits and pieces from him, that we're moving on. Yalfi is next. Thanks, Alan.
I'll sit over there.
Yeah, please. In front of the mic, Yalfi.
Sort of shown you a video of our credit committee, but it won't be nearly as entertaining. So I'll try and be brief. I think you guys have probably seen the sense. We've had a reasonable year, challenging in some areas. In the bank, which is our biggest business, we continue to grow the balance sheet quite pleasingly. We had a couple of quite nice one-offs in last year that we've been trying to run very hard to make up. And we won a couple of quite nice fleet contracts, but they've taken a while to land. And I guess we've made this comment before, but in the South African market over the last 12 months, 18 months, the decision-making process has always been very, very slow. And we, in our fleet business in particular, we're quite reliant on government tender business. Whereas I say we've been successful, for example, in landing the Transnet heavy commercial vehicle tender, but it took a while for the decision to be made, and then it takes a while for the rollout to proceed. We're right at the start of that now. So really the impact will only be seen in the next financial year.
Can I just give an example of that? Because that is, it's a reflection of what, you know, the impact on some of our businesses. I think Gopher was explaining to us that they were awarded and signed an LOI 18 months ago.
Yeah, not about 6 months ago, but nothing's happened.
But it
took about 18 months for the decision to be made.
Yeah.
So it's a long and slow process.
And they still haven't finalized the contract.
Yeah. So, but it's it remains a market that we like, and we know we do a good job there, so we continue to go after it. I guess our challenge in our fleet business is to grow our commercial fleet business, because that really is an area that we have not focused on or done particularly well in. Our business banking product has done very, very well. It comes off a low base, but the growth there is very pleasing. Float is growing. Our lending book is growing. Our number of clients grow, and our number of accounts carries on growing. And then we've got what I think is an undersold and underpromoted product, which is our Grow account. It's really a disruptive product in the retail space. It's a very cool product. We've got three wallets essentially in your transactional account. You've got a transactional wallet, a savings wallet, where you get paid about 6.5% interest. And then finally, we've got an invest wallet where you can buy through Easy Equities R5 worth of Nuspash if you want, or bundles, or ETFs, or anything else for that matter. So it's really the opportunity for anyone to invest. You don't have to have a vast amount of money to become an investor, and that's quite a cool product with a very, very accessible and easy-to-use app. So the bank's in reasonable space, and I think we're going to have a reasonably solid year. We've then got our life business called FMI, which is a modern life business, and if Brad Turing was sitting here, he'd keep you busy for an hour and a half spreading the gospel, but really what we do, we think, is to do life and income protection slightly differently. We don't necessarily sell people lump sum cover. We think that's unnecessarily expensive and not always fit for purpose. We do lump sum if required, but most of the stuff that we sell is income protection, whether you are unable to earn income either temporarily or permanently or are indeed dead. The growth in that business has been very, very pleasing, but with the growth has come a new business strain, so we will have some brackets around that result for this year. We won't make a profit yet. In the following financial year, we'll be very close to break even, but the kind of growth trajectory is very encouraging. I guess we're a smallish player in the market, but we're growing very, very pleasingly there. Our short-term insurance business, Bidvest Insurance, is heavily reliant on the motor vehicle channel for its sales, because we sell on the back of the motor vehicle sales typically value-added products, extended warranties and scratch and dent protection and, you know, tire guard and so on. So our penetration, which is something we measure quite closely, is good, but the volumes in that market are down, so that business is under a bit of pressure. And we are having a very good hard look at the commercial book that we're running in that business, because I don't think that it makes a lot of sense for us. So it's a very small part of our business and not particularly lucrative. So we're relooking that. Then if I look at our sort of slightly smaller businesses in the division, Compendium, our insurance brokerage, has had a very, very strong year. It's a tough environment. What they've found is that their clients are trading down, are cutting down on premiums.
are getting, and they're finding it more difficult to place the risk as the insurance market is hardening. But in spite of that, they've been able to grow, and that's been quite pleasing for us. They've also landed a smallish acquisition, which they can easily bolt onto their operation. In fact, have already bolted on. So that business is in good shape. We bought a business called Glassop and Associates, which we've rebranded to Best Wealth and Employee Benefits. That's a small pension fund administrator. And there was a little bit of panel beating and nursing required there, but that business is in good shape now, and we are now actively going out looking for new business. We, our single biggest client there happens to be the Bidvest Pension Fund, which is probably, as the team keep telling me, the most complicated fund in the country, because I think we've got, Lindsay, well over 200 pay points with some very bespoke and interesting requirements that came with the Bidvest growth over the last 30 years. So we were thrown in the deep end there, and I think the team did particularly well, and we're in a strong position to look for new business in that business. And maybe the final one I'll chat about quickly is FinGlobal, which is a very cool business based in Amanas. They do everything virtually. They deal with their clients only via the phone and mail. And what they do really is they help South Africans, typically that live overseas, get money out of the country. And these might be people that have been offshore for 10 years, haven't filled in a tax return for 10 years because they haven't earned money here, and granny has died, and they now have some money they want to externalize, and there's all sorts of hoops to jump through and red tape to deal with, and that's what FinGlobal do particularly well. And it could be anything from a very, very wealthy individual to someone who's got a couple of hundred thousand rand to take out the country. It's a nice business. It fits quite nicely with what we do in our bank because the kind of Forex and Saab BOP approval things we do in the bank anyway, but it's a nice little additional string to our bow. So I think the market is tough, and maybe what I didn't refer to in the bank environment is that, and I've got hands all over the wood here, is that what we've certainly expected to see are significantly increased defaults in particularly the business banking and the retail environment, and so far we've been protected from that. And I want to be very careful how I say this, but we do take a lot of care with the kind of credit that we grant. We make sure that it's very well secured. We monitor our book very, very, very carefully. So if I tell you that even Moody's suggested we take more risk. I'm very comfortable to be in the position we're in at the moment, given what the market's doing. And I hope I can sit here in a year's time and still tell you that our book has performed in that way. But so, at the moment, no real issues in the book. And we think that we're pretty well secured. So I guess...
And the investment portfolio?
Yeah, the investment portfolio is very, very difficult. I mean, I don't know where we're going to end. Any of you have any idea what... Probably wrong. I mean, we've got a madman in the US. We've got things, markets moving all over the place. You know, May was a disaster. June started well. The Rand's over 15 today. I mean, so we're going to have to mark to market that thing come the end of the year. And I'm afraid it's going to end up where it ends up. There's not a lot that we could do at this late stage of the year.
Obviously, at this stage, it's really shocking.
Yeah.
You guys know what the market is.
Yeah. So year on year, we're well done.
And our portfolio is managed by normal asset managers, and they've got all the normal stocks in it, and it's mostly equities, eh?
Yeah, so equities, cash, and bonds, a little bit of offshore, sort of quite a good, you know...
It's a normal balance, but it's
under pressure.
To this period that we're referring to, obviously it would be under severe pressure.
Can you say to some degree how that compares to the first half? I mean, has there been any improvement?
It's probably worse.
We're going to definitely be down year on year, I can tell you that much. I mean, you know, it depends what happens in June. So, end of June, we, you know.
The size of that fund?
About 700.
It's about 700 million.
The size of the fund? Just for those that didn't hear it, not the income statement movement, the size of the fund is 700.
Any comment perhaps on the pricing expectations of the vendors of the fleet management businesses that are on the market at the moment?
I don't really know how to answer that. There are a couple available. I guess the answer is that I've got on my left-hand side here a shareholder that is very careful not to overpay for a business. And in fact, I don't like overpaying for a business because I have to live with the consequences of that. So we've got, I think in our business, we've got a very robust process for going through acquisitions, and we test ourselves very carefully. And we, like Alan said, we are always on the lookout for deals, but we don't want to overpay. So I guess that's a good politician's answer for you. But there's a wide range of expectations in the market if one looks at the different businesses. And I guess our challenge is to make sure that if we look at a particular business, it's to make sure that we don't pay too much for it.
I mean, it seems that one of them at least has been on the market for quite a while.
I think I know, I think I'm aware of the one you're referring to. Yes.
Could I ask about your ROE from the bank? Those ROEs have come down over time. What do you think is the main cause of that, and what is your strategy to bring those sort of back up again?
I think two things really is that our historic fleet business was significantly more profitable than the new business we bring on board. We still like the new business. Give us a good return. But some of the historic contracts were slightly more favorable. But more importantly is that we have, over time, invested quite a bit of money in our bank in particular. People, systems, and then compliance. I mean, the kind of, that's the perennial. You know, the kind of compliance costs just go up and up and up and up. So we're not happy with our cost-to-income ratio at the moment. It's too high. It's something that we were absolutely aware of when we went down this track, and we deliberately spent the money, but the top line, you know, needs to catch up, and that's, I guess, our focus. So if I look year on year at our expenses, we keep them very tightly under control. But we've got, you know, quite big IT projects that we've landed where we're writing those things off over the next couple of years, and that lives with us. So I guess it's a combination of some historic and some cost, and I'm pretty confident that we can fix that with top-line growth, which is, I guess, the way to work yourself out of it.
Are you seeing a pipeline for the tenders for the fleet contracts? Can you see quite a few tenders coming up in the next few years, or is that sort of pipeline starting to dry up a bit?
No, there's a significant pipeline. Yeah, there's a very big pipeline. I mean, if we were to land everything in the pipeline, we'd need to raise some serious capital. And we are well overcapitalized at the moment, just to give you an idea. So I think there's been a bit of a logjam. The point I made right at the beginning is I think that decision-making with caretaker CEOs and caretaker DGs and boards that were in turmoil, the kind of large contracts just either weren't dealt with or were sort of kicked down the line. And so I do think that we need to see a couple landing. I mean, City of Joburg have got a number of quite big fleet deals that are due to land in the next short while. You know, exactly who gets them, we'll see. But there's a lot of stuff happening. And I think that we've seen the logjam starting to unlock, which is good news. It's a bit of work in progress, and I think what the mix of our business is changing too. So our fleet, we want to continue to grow, and that's a very important part of our business, but we're seeing the other parts of the bank growing too. And one of the other things that I think we've also said publicly, as all the other banks have, is that we are bricks and mortar. We'll have for the foreseeable future, but I think our branch footprint, even our small one, is probably a little bigger than it should be. So, a long answer, but I think that there are quite a lot of moving parts that we'll see come together over the next 12 to 18 months. Quite a key period for us to try and sort all of that out. So I think probably 20% better than we have at the moment. I'd be happy with
it. Did you say you're overcapitalized?
Well, we're sitting on quite a lot of cash. And that's been
quite a few deliberate anticipation of a lot of these Transnet deals, etc. City of Joburg, National Transport.
Yeah, there have been a number.
It's a massive contract.
And it was a deliberate, we've deliberately raised the cash, and we've significantly improved our yield on our cash in our treasury. So the treasury's done a good job. So we're not uncomfortable sitting on the cash. We're getting a reasonable return on it. Our cost of funds has remained over this period pretty stable. In fact, it's come down slightly, so we're happy with that too. That's not growing, so we're not buying the cash at rates that we can't afford. So we're happy with it, and but it's in anticipation of a couple of these bigger things coming through.
We have slowed down a bit on the deposits.
We have, yeah.
We've slowed down on the deposits. I think when Mark gives you an idea on the on the balance sheets and the cash flow, you'll see that
it's still growing, but
down just because they're so well capitalized.
Turning
that cash back on is not that difficult.
Yeah. Our rates are good, and we're one notch behind below the big banks with our Moody's rating, so for us to attract deposits is reasonably easy, and we can turn that tap on and off to a reasonable extent.
I'll see whether we can push him back into the next lot just so we can keep with the dial-in program. So we'll have a quick lunch, and then we'll come back in about 25 minutes for the rest of the divisional updates and the top-down view. Okay. So for the participants on the line, if you could redial in at about 25 past, please, operator. Please help yourself to some food. Commercial product before we go to the top-down perspective. And over to you, thank you.
Okay. Afternoon, everybody. A lot of you have been around for many years, so now business as well. We have seven businesses, and I've always been reluctant. I know you guys always push me, how big is this one, how big is that one? And I've always been reluctant to do that, so maybe I'll just hint towards that a little bit this afternoon. Because we see our businesses in sort of three pockets, and the three pockets are quite different and performing quite differently at the moment. And I think to understand where we are straight overall, perhaps to look at those three pockets and talk about that. And the first one is obviously our biggest business, and becoming bigger all the time, is our bulk liquid business, is this tank terminals. And I think we have described that previously as an annuity type business, or more or less a landlord type business. So it's more dependent upon renting the tanks out than upon volumes. So whilst we've seen volumes fall during the last year and our customers have been struggling, you obviously don't see that come through too much in the business unless you should lose a tank or something like that. And we've lost a few tanks, but thankfully most of them we've managed to replace by some of our bigger customers looking for more tankage, because there's still a shortage of tankage in the country. So that business has performed very well this year. We continue to invest large sums of money in that business, as you're aware, and I think we will continue to do that. The LPG project has received a whole lot of press recently. You guys have seen all of that. Ilza spends a lot of time showing nice photos and that, so maybe we'll just take a break and she wants to show you a few more. So this is the site in Richards Bay. Obviously in Richards Bay we're getting the site ready for the large tanks that have been built in China. They will be floated across here and then pushed onto the site. That's the inside of the tank. Carry on. That's from the outside. There are four tanks like that, four bullets or tanks. You can see the people there. I'll give you an idea of how big they are. These are, each tank is the biggest tank ever being built in the world. So the site won't be the biggest in the world, each individual tank is the biggest ever built. For LPG, sorry. Yeah.
Is that it, Jordan?
And there's the site. You'll see those platforms essentially will take each one of the tanks in Richards Bay. The site is almost ready to take the tanks. We're hoping the tanks will be here, obviously, I'm shipping about September. Is that it, Ilza?
Yep.
Okay. So, that's the first business. News is good, and we don't really see that changing going forward. As I said, only growing as we get return on the large capital that we've been invested. The second area of our business is our agricultural business. It's a very, very different model. It is highly reliant upon volume. We have large capital invested as we do in the bulk liquid, but if the volume's there, we make nice money. If the volume's not there, we struggle. Last year, we had an absolutely bumper year because South Africa was exporting a lot of maize. Continued a bit into this year, and we got that benefit of that in the first 6 months. But unfortunately, November, it stopped in its tracks, and we've seen nothing since, and probably the next maize exports that we see will only be in the new financial year. Having said that, we have had reasonable volumes of wheat imports, rice has grown, and some of the other commodities, but they're obviously not as big as the maize export program, have been okay. So the business has performed, it's performed normal for a year, but obviously it doesn't look great when you compare it to the bumper year that we had last year. So that third of our business, as I'd like to call it, is more or less our swinger. You know, some years you'll have good luck with high volumes, some years you won't. And this year the volumes are not bad, but they're just not the bumper that we had last year. Then the third sector I want to just talk about is everything else. And to describe everything else really relies upon the economy of South Africa. So there are two parts to that. You can, it's very complex, but to simplify it, it's imports and exports. South Africa is very much a commodity-driven export country. And exports of commodities at the moment and through this year have been good. Okay, so we've seen new products come on stream. We've been doing quite a lot of chrome through chrome exports through Durban, chrome ores. Manganese has come back a little bit to Durban, which we weren't expecting. And then in our other businesses, in BPO, where we're doing stevedoring, etc., they've benefited from the exports of those commodities throughout the country, where they do little bits and pieces of work for it. And then places like SACD, there's also a big demand to put the minerals and everything into containers and export those containers, obviously, to the east. So that half of the rest of the South African economy, if I can call it, has been good to us, okay? Then the other half, if I can call it that, so if you go back to these three pockets, and I'm now talking a half of a third, if you see what I'm saying, in terms of our performance, has been an absolute shocker, okay? And that really is what you're seeing a lot of what a lot of people call our competitors, but I don't like to say that because we're in quite different markets. Not a lot of our business is in that. And that would be in the distribution, the warehousing, trucking, etc. What's happening in that market is there's been a significant amount of capacity put into that market. And at the time that everybody's putting warehouses onto the market, volumes have fallen, okay? And if you're paying for very expensive warehouses and you don't have volume, you get desperate. So what's happened with those two factors, you've added on top of that, everybody's slashing rates. So hence you're seeing some carnage out in that market. We are suffering from it in the businesses where we do that, but I don't want to say too much more on that. You've seen all the problems with trucks on the roads. Those are all true. But it's not, although it's in our lives every day, it's not our whole business, if you see what I'm saying. So if you put that whole lot together, where are we overall? We're not having as good a second 6 months because of the loss of the grain as we did in the first 6 months, but we're doing okay. Yeah, and as I said, as soon as the grains come back, you'll see that it picks us up again. Gilda, have I said enough, or do you want me to say more, take questions? Probably better to take questions.
Just sort of what previously user on labour unrest that
the labour unrest. Okay. In what areas? A lot of our businesses are more asset intensive rather than people type businesses. A significant portion of our businesses could run on skeleton staff and run reasonably well. So what we find more, the labour unrest that's caused us more problems than anything else is the truckers causing road congestion. And we're having to work around that. You know, once sort of the container trucks stop, obviously all the other trucks will stop behind them. So it's not a big factor in our life, if that answers your question. Yeah.
And often in tank terminals, you mentioned sort of when customers come under pressure.
Yeah.
Are you seeing any negative aversions on the sort of rental, as you like, on those
tanks? Absolutely not, because of the demand. Well, I don't like to mention our customers' names, but it's quite obvious it's one of them, a Sasol. Now, Sasol are regularly demanding more tanks, and that would be the bottom of the market rate that you would be prepared to take. So, you know, whilst you're getting that on the warehousing side because of the highly competitive and the oversupply, you're certainly not getting that on the tankage side because of the shortage relative to the country overall. Yeah. So we're still getting reasonable price increases in that business. Yeah. Question. Came all the way from Durban.
The LPG project is in budget.
And on time.
And on time.
That's on time. That's been quite nice.
Yeah, the planned date for startup, obviously, and when I say startup, is when does the customer start giving us a nice monthly check, is the 1st of July next year, but there obviously are some very nice performance guarantees in the contract for early delivery, and we're hoping that we'll be a few months earlier than that. That's what the plan shows now, but obviously that's reliant upon shipping and weather and the following, so... We sort of, hopefully a few months before that. Yeah.
Can you just remind us, what is the total budget?
The budget was just short of $1 billion, the project, the capital spend.
Okay, so that's going to hit your desired returns pretty quickly.
Straight away.
And the reason the return is so high, when you saw that, those pictures that Ilza was showing, it's on an existing site of ours. It's really got all the service. It's a service site. So we just got to plonk some tanks down and off we go. So our CapEx, if we had to do it from scratch, and on a brand new piece of land, would be at least double.
Because a lot of, and obviously the office blocks and the people and all the services are already there, it would be significantly more. Yeah.
Is the model the same, that you're going to rent out those tanks to customers, so a customer rents the whole
one
tank?
One customer.
We've already signed this deal.
All four of them.
We've announced that before, but all four of them are taken by one customer. It's the biggest gas trader in the world for 10 years.
Take or pay
for 10 years, the option for another 10. So.
Yeah.
At a return of in excess of 20% after tax, which we announced before.
Don't forget, we're carrying the cost during the build period. Yeah, so that's why he must pay from day one. So it's not all positive for us. Yeah.
Yeah, and this year it's not.
Yeah.
Just your distribution, trading, and warehousing area where you're saying rates have come down quite considerably. Can you give an indication of how much additional capacity needs to be absorbed in the market? And to what extent rate, generally speaking, I know it's not easy to generalize, but what sort of rate reductions have you seen?
It's quite a complex because, the easiest figure to show you there would be on the warehousing per square meter, because obviously it gets complicated for once you start moving products depending on your stacking capacity, etc. So if you looked at how much warehousing was coming into the market, and if anybody's driven on the N2 recently from Durban to Joburg, you'll see suddenly everybody's inventing all these new logistics hubs as you go through each block, which is quite dangerous because you're starting to stop the cargo in odd places. And I see yet another one was announced by Transnet yesterday. Those are expensive, but everybody just goes and says, well, let's just put warehousing there. We will rent it out. But I'll give you some examples. If you take Durban as an example, and obviously that is a modal point where stuff has to move from the sea onto the land. I mean, the old Clarewood Racecourse, which is probably 72 hectares, they have just built a 20,000 square meter warehouse. And I was talking to them this week. They're putting another 50,000 on spec onto that site. There is the old PX site, which is on Edwin Swales Drive. There is 85,000 square meters of warehousing going up there as we are talking. And that's an environment where you've seen some of the results of some of these logistics guys. You know, if you looked at the rates, 5 years ago, it wasn't unusual to pay 85 rand a square meter for warehousing in Durban. You could probably do a deal at about 60 now. If that gives you an idea. I would think that these guys are not able to put warehousing on the ground for much less than 85. So if they're taking 60 or 65, they're burning.
Ross, you had a question?
Thanks, Anthony. I'm just wondering on the take-or-pay agreement, how much spare capacity is there if demand is better than what's in the take-or-pay?
Okay. It's quite complicated, but quite simple. The tanks are massive, massive, massive. And the reason that they were built like that is because that's the size of the ship. So the whole concept was built on the fact of bringing in a big ship to bring the shipping rate down, which is significantly more than the storage. So it's all about shipping rates. So you're bringing that there. We've got far too much stock for the demand in the market at the moment. Okay. So as the demand goes up, all you're going to do is increase the throughput. And so you've got significant growth in that facility as it stands, if that makes sense. Am I making sense?
Yeah. There'll be more ships coming,
The ship will just turn it quicker.
Yeah. Okay.
We would have liked to build that size. We would rather have built, to be honest, 10% of the size and just turn it quickly.
Yeah.
Okay. But you can't do that because then you're only, the ships are a size. You're only taking 10% of the shipload, if that makes sense. Yeah.
And just maybe to put the demand in perspective, in South Africa, our LPG per capita consumption is 6 kilograms per person.
Yeah.
If you go to places in Africa or emerging markets where electricity distribution is not greatest, you can go up 45, 60 kgs per capita. So we think if the supply gets sorted out.
So to answer your question, I mean, it's quite obvious that the tanks Why they're on a take or pay on a commitment like that is because the savings in the shipping rates on current demand will pay for the facility to answer. Yeah. And so you can see how the benefit will come through as they start getting a higher demand and pushing the throughput through.
So I mean, you could make much more than your guided return if the demand.
The money to be made, a lot of it, don't forget, will be made by the trader. So our model is more like but we do get something for throughput. So it'll be a little bit better, but it's, you know, if the demand doubles, we're not going to double our return.
Okay, perfect. Thanks a lot.
We may eventually have to build more tanks, which we'd love to do.
Consumer product imports through the ports. How are you? What trends are you seeing there?
Product imports.
Consumer products.
Consumer product imports.
Yeah.
That all comes back to why your demand for all your warehousing and everything is down. It's carnage. So it's way down, and you can get all the stats of, you know, from Transnet on the imports, you know, and all the work that we do around that, customs work, customs stops, etc. All those are significantly down. And that's an area where obviously all the logistics guys are battling. Yeah.
And you've seen on consumer or industrial? I think your question was mainly consumer, consumer goods. Seeing it across the board.
You're seeing it across the board, eh? Yeah. Yeah.
Besides projects like this LPG project, how do you grow the freight division?
How do you grow the freight division? The freight division is very much reliant upon the growth of South Africa. Okay. So, you know, for example, we spoke of agriculture. You know, there's three agricultural terminals in Durban. They very underutilized, you know, growth in the country will mean what I was saying, will help to use the assets that we've got on the ground more, you know. What we can't do is what guys are doing now, just go and throw money on the ground and infrastructure whilst the volumes are falling in certain areas. So, you know, there are, we have to follow a product. We can't do what a lot of people do, say, let's put up a warehouse and hopefully one day the product will come. That's not our model. So South African growth is the answer to your question.
And acquisitive growth?
Well, there's a lot on the market. There's a lot of trucks and a lot of warehouses on the market at the moment. And, you know, for obvious reasons, we're avoiding them. The returns that guys are getting on that is, you know, some of these, you look at a 6 to 8%. You know, it's just not what we do. Is that it?
Yep.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Well, I got
it. And keen to stay, so you've been on.
He's not going to run the Comrades, but he needs to be on a plane to where the Comrades will be run.
Otherwise, you won't get a plane. I'll just run it. Daily merits for the way
down. No, things are not that bad. I think, you know, everything goes in cycles. Logistics size a bit low, it'll come back.
And touch on your overseas on time, just for 2 minutes.
Okay. On time, you asked about acquisitive growth. Obviously, one of the areas is where we go offshore. I mean, here we're a reasonable fish in a small sea, but over there, obviously, we're tiny. We did have the one business on time, which is doing distribution for some of the luxury brands over there of vehicles. And that business is doing very nicely. And that, you know, obviously, our thinking there is that could be a springboard for growing into a logistics business in the UK. Yeah. But it's very small. I mean, it's tiny in our numbers. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Next up is Mr. Keyes on automotive.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, everyone. Please excuse the voice. And because Alan Feynman's gone, I can say it was because I was supporting the best team in Europe over the weekend. automotive market, let's deal with retail first. Retail's really a tale of two segments of the market. Volume segment of the market, although the overall market is in its fourth year of contraction, the volume segment of the market is kind of holding up. Probably not as profitable as it was 3-4 years ago at the height of the market, but holding up really relatively well. The real pain in the auto retail sector is really in the luxury brands, where volumes from their peaks in 2015 have pretty much halved over this period. I'll tell you what the solution to the problem, or our solution to that problem is a bit later. The used vehicle area of the business, volumetrically, in historic downturns or down cycles, we typically used to see an uptick in used vehicle trading profitability. As consumers migrated from the affordability strains of new cars and embraced the used vehicle as an alternative. In this cycle, it hasn't been characteristic. And what we've seen is that volumes have remained relatively static, but there's been a bit of margin pressure. What we are seeing is that the offers in new vehicles, the great offers that some of the manufacturers are bringing, is competing at the bottom end, at the bottom end of the used car market, competing at the top end of the new used car market. In the after-sales area, also a little bit challenging now after 3 years of contraction, because in the franchise businesses, which is where we play, a lot of our aftermarket work is done on motor plans and in warranty. Now, as the contraction of the new vehicle sales filters through, that volume throughput starts impacting in the back end of your business, in your after-sales activity. There is a counter to that, and that is to try and engage with the customers to encourage them back into the franchise network after the motor plan has expired, obviously to try and extend motor plans, et cetera, et cetera. Customers where motor plans and warranties have expired back into the franchise network, because they typically would go to a second-tier supplier there. But you have to do that by discounting the offer. So there is a bit of margin pressure there. On the motor vehicle retail side of the business, what do we expect going forward? We pretty much are seeing more of the same because we are a function of the economy of South Africa. And until there's confidence, we're seeing more of the same. We're seeing a market kind of bumbling along the bottom for a bit until the signs of economic activity start manifesting themselves in fixed investment in this country, because that will be the stimulus to people gaining some confidence and starting to move in their car purchasing decisions. And also the fleets, coming into the market and buying fleets again. At the moment, they're extending the lives of their fleets, and this is why luxury gets impacted more than volume, is because if you're in a luxury car, you're in a decent car anyway. So your decision to defer a luxury purchase is easier made than if you're in the volume segment and where that vehicle very often is used as a tool of trade. We're not seeing any bright white lights in the motor vehicle retail end of the market just yet. However, that is not to say that we're not taking action. What we have done, what we've been focusing on for probably the last 18 months, 2 years now, is rationalization of our footprint, rationalization of brands we represent, right-sizing the business to the level of economic activity, and getting greater efficiency through the footprint that we have. That has come at the cost, unfortunately, of jobs, that is really what how our whole industry has had to experience. Greater use of technology is also a real cornerstone of what we're attempting to achieve in the retail segment of the market, and a lot of those initiatives are starting to bear fruit now. In terms of the performance, we're a number of listed competitors have motor componentry, and we've seen their results, and we're in the same game. In terms of car rental, we had a really poor 2018. I'm happy to report that car rental 2019 is a different place. The management team there has done a really good job of right-sizing the business, of getting the business back on track in terms of profitability, and trading profits have normalized off the back of greater fleet utilization and efficiency, and then also some modest rate increases that we've managed to secure in the market. Happily, a really huge project that has taken a year has been the updating of our IT infrastructure in that business, both in terms of front-end and back-end processes. That has been completed. It regrettably, that modernization has resulted in us putting some of the innovation that we have developed on hold until the new front end systems could cope. But we are now in a position to start delivering some of that innovation and hopefully some margin improvement in that business going forward. In a phase of a market like this, a lot of independent operators start feeling strained. So on the acquisition side, quite a lot of activity and opportunity for bolt-ons to add to our existing infrastructure without impacting any need to invest further in back-end infrastructure. So both on the retail and in the car rental space, there are a number of acquisitions being worked on. They're not huge, they're small bolt-on acquisitions that can give us some scale. If that's okay.
Steve, just in the car rental, so within those segments that you service the insurance industry, tourism, which business are you seeing more pressure in? Is it like, you know, one day rentals going down or?
Probably, yeah. There are two areas where there's been a bit of strain in that industry. The one is corporate travel, certainly. And corporate forms a big part of our portfolio. That has certainly come down a little. And inbound tourism has been patchy, a little bit dull for us. Where we have performed is that we've been able to sign up a bit more in the line of corporate, as opposed some new clients. So we've gained some share. But the inbound is also down. Mm. And that's nice yielding business.
I think Paulette did report at a board meeting that the one-day rentals are down. That's one that's under pressure.
Yeah.
And that's normally a corporate.
That's normally a corporate.
That's a corporate guy flying in.
Corporate travel, are you switching to Uber? Or?
I think it's just less corporate travel.
I think it's less corporate travel.
Uber's not that well accepted by big corporates. They don't allow their execs to use it.
Interestingly enough, what we are also seeing is we're starting to see a lot more responsibility from the corporate market in terms of transporting those staff members who need to work at odd hours in the call centers and things like that to get a transport solution from them, from the centre of Johannesburg, to their homes after a shift at 9 o'clock at night. So there's some new niches that are developing in the marketplace that we're exploring.
I said used this week. Are you kind of tracking how we buy cars and those kind of volumes are doing? Is there any impact?
We buy cars has had an impact on the franchise motor business across the board. What we buy cars has done in this market is they've kind of consolidated a lot of the traditional independent used car traders into a megastore. However, it must be noted that more than 60% of the volume of cars that they do buy and sell actually goes to on sellers, to the retailers. We are all in the industry. I think every motor group is developing a strategy and has developed a strategy to counter the impact of the rebuy cars. From a personal perspective, the fact that the NASPAS transaction was put on hold is positive for the franchise motor business in that the tie-up of the marketing element and the bricks and mortar would have posed a threat. It gives us a bit more time and for us to unroll a strategy to counter the rebuy cars scenario. And certainly, we've been running pilots for the last three months in our motor retail business, and it's coming out quite fast.
When you have a look at the current ownership change that we see that took place within Unitrans Auto, and the focus potentially being more on the Toyota brand, how are you thinking about that? Are there opportunities of the other brands that might come out there?
Firstly, I mean, it was quite a strange announcement in that it wasn't a signed deal, and I'm not even sure whether it's signed yet. It was an announcement, a SENS announcement, that was predicated on an agreement in principle. So I'm not sure exactly where that transaction is. It certainly hasn't featured yet in any dispatches with the Competition Board. But it certainly will provide certain opportunities to the motor groups in terms of the non-Toyota franchise dealer componentry of Unitrans Motors. In that, the ownership of CFAO, who's the purchaser, is vested effectively with the Toyota group, ultimately, and a number of the local OEMs will feel fairly uncomfortable having their retail exposure exposed to a competitor. So we do believe that there's fallout. There's going to be some fallout. We would be very interested in pursuing some of the opportunities.
And then,
sorry.
Sorry, can I just more question? Just you mentioned the fact that as your new cars start to roll off the warranties, etc., but to what extent are you managing to hold on to that annuity stream within servicing? Because obviously you get it after a certain number of years, things come off service plan as well.
Yeah.
That
is the challenge. That's precisely the challenge. We've put some innovative product in to try and extend those service plans to engage with those customers to keep them in-house. But there is a migration. And it's then to try and substitute that migration with a market that historically has gone to the second tier servicing area. So it is proving challenging, I think, to all of us in the franchise motor business, and lots of strategies being developed to try and plug that gap. And also add additional product, servicing product.
So just looking back at your rebranding exercise in terms of car rental, then it's been quite a difficult growth phase in terms of getting acceptance and recognition. where are you in terms of where you are in, under the prior to the rebranding? Have you clawed back sufficient, or are you clawing back sufficient market share from where you were in terms of, say, global brands previously?
Sure. The rebranding exercise caused a small drop-off in share in the market. But that small drop-off in share was actually not in the inbound market, interestingly enough. It is into our insurance replacement. We lost a big client in the service insurance replacement business at that time. So it appeared like we had lost a whole lot more share than we did. We've clawed back that that share, and we are now at a share at an equivalent share to before the rebranding exercise. The real shift in that took place as a consequence of the rebranding exercise was that historically we had to pay a royalty for the international brand, and we've had to now substitute that royalty spend with a marketing spend to attract the same customer base. Interestingly enough, the brand was budget, and budget didn't do a heap of good for us in the inbound market. We had to actually go and secure that independently anyway. So it was the right decision, and it's now really manifesting itself in our ability to be a bit more agile when and move as the market moves, whereas when you were under the governance of an international brand, they dictated when you had to replace vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. You can be a little bit more fleet of foot now in managing the fleet.
So you're clawing back in, are you growing in the inbound market in terms of your...
Pretty static in inbound, but where we are kicking some goals is in the corporate market, and a little bit in leisure, where we have been historically weak. When I say leisure, I'm talking SA leisure market. We've been historically a little bit weak there.
And but we're back to where we were.
Yeah, absolutely back to where we were.
And that's after giving up, effectively giving up that insurance business because it was at such ridiculously low margins, we almost walked away from it.
Perhaps a quick question on inventory levels. Given what the Rand has done over the last few months, one would think that price increases, big ones, are inevitable. It doesn't bode well for the next 6 months.
Look, it's probably not going to manifest itself necessarily in the next 6 months. It'll probably be a bit longer than that because most of those inventory orders are 6 months in advance. There will be a bit of pricing pressure in the market that will manifest itself out of currency weakness. However, having said that, the South African consumer is such a resilient beast. And I think the domestic OEMs are going to have to accept that if they want to achieve share, they need to absorb some of that. So, and that's been a sort of a characteristic feature of the SA market in the last 18 months from the OEMs.
You must remember, when the OEMs put their prices up, which they did when the Rand was 15 some years ago, they never brought it down. Because that messed it up to the used car market. So the pricing of vehicles was pushed up quite significantly 2 years ago and never reduced down. It doesn't, the price of them, if you look at the price of vehicles, they don't do this. They're not linked to the exchange.
No, they always creep up. And
so their margins have been quite good for a period. Now their margins will go back to normality. So they shouldn't have.
This
market, guys like Daimler cars are happy.
Yeah.
What's the stat that you gave me the other day?
Yeah,
in 2015,
they sold 28,500 units in this market. Last year, they sold 14,500 units.
Exactly 50%. In other words, they can afford to price themselves and then just drop even further. So we started with just based on holding pricing for some time. Look, providing the rand stays above 15, you know, if it goes much worse, then they're going to have to.
There will be creep, but we're not going to go back to the 80s when we, you know, when it was just kind of 4% a quarter.
Do you have any of VAL in your portfolio?
We don't have a VAL. They're doing well in the market. I think some of the groups that have embraced the brand have used it to fill facilities that were going begging as a result of their rationalization. My understanding is that the guys are doing okay at retail level. Because remember, the wholesaling of that, or distribution of that, is handled by GWM. I've driven the product. The product's good. It's probably the best Chinese product I've seen. Jury's still out on after-sales support, and hence we haven't gone to represent the brand at this point, because historically the Chinese have been very, very poor at after-sales service. And, you know, we need to protect the reputation.
Thanks, Steve. Much appreciated. Commercial products.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Well, I'll keep this just like me, short and sweet. It's a breeze out there. Things are very good. But I think I'll just give some general comments first, and then I'll go into some specifics. So I'll give you some general comments, and then I will give you a few specifics. I think what's been crucial that we've done very well this year is margin management. Turnover is always tough. Margin management is more in our control. And we've been pretty good on that from two fronts. One is obviously pricing at the customer. And second is where we source our products and how we position ourselves in the market. So that's been crucial for us. The other very important thing that I think we've done very well this year is our cash generation, which obviously comes from profitability and managing our assets. So those will always be the cornerstones of this division. The division is really based on two segments, a consumer segment, which is about a third of the turnover of the division, and an industrial segment, which is about two-thirds of the turnover. Industrial sector is a tough sector, tough space to be in at the moment. Very little confidence in the marketplace. No secret why the confidence is so low, but that's just the way it is. Agriculture, we also deal with it. It's pretty uncertain with the land issue, so just the investment into plant and machinery and equipment, etc., is a bit tough. And obviously, construction is a blood bond. So what we've had to do is we've obviously continually right-sized the business. We restrict some of the trading ourselves because of credit limits. Construction industry, very difficult to supply anyone. There may be one decent construction company left. The non-payment by the main contractors to the subcontractors, it obviously has a great knock-on effect, and it's something that we need to manage. So we obviously insure a lot with credit guarantee. We stick to those limits. Where we can get insurance, where we can't get insurance, we'd rather not trade. But it's just not worth taking bad debt just for the sake of it. There are some green shoots. We do see commodity prices having lifted. We see some mining activity again. There's a lot more interest there. We obviously sell quite a bit of product in there. some of our bigger businesses, Plumblink, there are three markets that they operate in. One is the plumbers themselves for daily use, repairs and maintenance. That sector of the business has grown double digits this year. And it's just the footprint. We celebrated the opening of our 100th store a couple of weeks ago. When we bought the business three odd years ago, we had something like 52 or 55 stores. So we've grown that very, very nicely. The second part of the business that has done well is the insurance replacement market for geezers. That's also grown double digits in this year. But the one area that we have gone backwards in is the contract section, where a lot of contracts in South Africa have been put on hold or delayed. So we haven't done as well in that sector as we would have liked to. Having said all of that, in about 2 weeks' time, we will celebrate with the management of Plumblink. They've done a fantastic job there. They will have doubled their turnover in 5 years. And I think it's a really fantastic achievement. The GFOX business, which is workwear and PPE, which is protective equipment, also had a reasonably good year. A lot of contracts. They have a very large factory in Swaziland. We have a lot of direct contracts. We are doing a fair amount of export in there, and we're trying to expand that as well. We just acquired a business for them, a glove business, protective gloves. Fox themselves had a sector of the market that had gloves, so we have a small share in that market which we plan to grow, and there's a lot of upside we see in that area. I think one of our problematic businesses in the industrial sector is a company called Rentec. Rentec really deals with the electricity departments and, well, when I say the departments, the likes of Eskom, as well as petrochemicals. The huge rental fleet that they have there, two sectors to the business. One is a rental fleet, and the other is obviously just buying and selling welding equipment. Obviously, that goes directly into construction, really substantially down. Projects at Eskom really ground to a halt this year. Very interesting to see that we have a contract with one of Eskom's suppliers who actually performs a lot of the repair work. And whilst we thought that there would be a huge amount of work coming from them from November when they said they were going to do more repairs and maintenance, we haven't seen too much of that yet. We've been promised that we will see it, but it's really not forthcoming yet. So we've had to take corrective action in that business, but it's not all doom and gloom. There are petrochemical companies that, whilst they have delayed some of the repair work, it is ongoing. I think one of our other very cyclical businesses, a company called Vulcan, which is catering equipment business, they've had a poor year. The order book there's no problem with that. It's a lot of the contracts get delayed and put off. And again, it's because of uncertainty in the marketplace. They deal with a wide spectrum of customers, the likes of famous brands, the likes of Nando's, KFC, so the QSR, the quick service restaurants, then they deal with hotels, prisons, anyone who needs an industrial kitchen. So we've got a very large order book. We just can't execute it because of delays in projects. So that business will come back at some stage when those projects roll out, but it's been pretty tough in that space. From a consumer perspective, surprisingly, we've done fantastically well in that area. Home and Living Brands, which is Russell Hobbs, small appliances in the main, market share gains. We also feel that the retailers have working capital constraints, so rather than importing themselves, they can get terms from us, and they can also, there's a huge issue within that of returns because of breakages or whatever. The consumer doesn't like their kettle. All they do is they take it back to the retailers. They then have to deal with it. It's a big logistical exercise, and I guess instead of doing it themselves, they can bring it to us to deal with should we supply the product. So we've taken a lot of market share there. We are seeing a lot of problems at the retailers' distribution centres in that they can't get the product onto the shelves of their stores. So it's a well-documented fact that ShopRite Checkers have DC issues. Game have got serious DC issues. And we get affected by that because whilst we deliver product into the DC, our product doesn't necessarily get into the shelf, get onto the shelf timelessly. So we are trying to work with them to make that system more efficient. And also, obviously, there's a lot of disruption at some of, well, at Game in particular. We're trying to work with them that we can get that show back on the road. But having said all of that, they've had a very, very good year. The Yamaha business has had a fair year. We've had to change the model in terms of motorbikes only, motorbikes and motorboats. We bought our own, our first retail store, which is our largest dealer here in Randburg. We bought that and shut it down for a few months while we did repairs and maintenance there, fixed the place up. We've just opened our second dealership in Linwood in Pretoria, and very soon World of Yamaha, which is our flagship showroom here in Marlborough, we will open that to retail as well. It's not to say we're doing away with dealers, but that model was properly broken and we felt that we need proper representation, so we've gone that route ourselves. Certainly our thinking behind it in the planning stage has proven to be correct, because it doesn't cost us any more to hold inventory in those stores because we just held it in our warehouse. So the funding cost there is no more than what it was. It's just a matter of making the dealerships profitable. Cellini, which is the luggage business, comprises of three parts. First, it's the wholesale division, which supplies other luggage stores. Secondly, it's the Cellini stores, which are in the major malls in South Africa. And thirdly, it's the airport stores at South African airports. It's had a very good year. It also won a tender to supply all the luggage to South African Airways, and yes, we have been paid for it. it's had a very good year. What this business did about 18 months ago is, because it's a luxury item, they repriced, they resourced their product so that they could be price specific in what is a tough market, and it's been very good for them. I think just a few other comments. Acquisitions remain on top of our list to look at. We look at a lot of businesses. We are very selective in what we look at. Some pricing in the marketplace is totally unrealistic, and obviously we can't look at that. Another point that I must make is our management remain motivated despite tough times in South Africa. I think it's very important to have motivated management. I think it's very important to remain positive in what is quite a negative environment, or it was quite a negative environment, but I think we need to look for positives and move forward. And I think we remain disciplined in the way that we do business. We won't chase a sale for the sake of a sale. As I was taught by Brian Joffe 25 years ago, if you don't have enough goods to fill a truck, don't put more goods in. Buy a smaller truck. And I think that's what you have to do in today's market. So I'm very happy to answer any questions.
So when you have a look at the overall mix of the business, in the first half you did very well to keep your profits largely flat. Would you say that, you say that things are tough, but there's a bit of balance there. Has overall things got worse, or?
They have got worse in the second half, no question about that. Also, just for no other reason than we had quite a weak first half last year. The last period, beyond the comparative. But I don't think we'll be embarrassed by the results. I'm certainly not award winning. There are some decent results within there.
It's a bit of a mixed bag. So some of the consumers are still doing okay. But we definitely felt the pressure of, and I think it goes across the board, which I'll cover when I talk, but these 4 months have definitely seen a tightening compared to the first six of last year, or our first half.
And you spoke a bit about the debtors, but just can you comment on the inventory levels across the division?
Yeah, so, I mean, the inventory levels are pretty good, depends which way you look at that, but we try to manage that as best as what we can. Obviously, what we are seeing now is inflation because the rand is tense. And whilst it's good in the short term for us because if you put your prices up and you've got old price stock, you can make a one-off profit. I don't think it's good for the country, and I don't think it's good for confidence. So we have managed our inventory and our cash generation. Probably 90% of our profit that we've made, we've generated that as cash. So, you know, it's pretty good.
Can I ask on your disposal, because often talk about acquisitions, and,
yes.
But on the disposal side, how do you decide whether a company should be disposed of in your portfolio, especially in times like this when there are going to be companies operating at a loss but may turn around? So how do you sort of assess whether it's a permanent thing you should sell or whether you stick it out for a few years?
I think you need to determine in principle whether you think it's a good business and there's a place for it in South Africa. If the answer is yes and the business isn't doing well, the next thing you need to understand is, do you have the right management and do we have the right teams in there and the right strategy? If the answer to all of that is no, I guess we would then look to sell it. I haven't looked at sell too many. There is, right in the beginning of this division, we looked at selling Burzax as a company. Industrial sewing machines, boring, it also had a consumer division. We did something very simple. We took a consumer business and we put it into Home and Living Brands because that is the home of consumer. And we took this business and our hardened MD who had experience with clothing retailers. And we partnered with the Fashini Group who four and a half years ago, were importing 90% of their product. And they wanted to make goods locally because in fashion today, speed to the market, it's all about that. Today, 45% of their production is all local. We partnered with them. We supply them. We supply Pep, Levi Jeans, all the big manufacturers. And that business's profits has trebled over the last 3 years. So you just need to understand before you're actually going to go and sell it as to do we have the right strategy. And I guess at the end of the day, if it doesn't make the returns after all of that, we would decide to go and dip it. I don't think we've been very good.
Yeah.
We're not very good sellers.
Yeah. Have you disposed many businesses in the last year?
No.
We have elsewhere, though, which I'll touch on. Yeah, we have TMS, Seating, TMS. Any other questions?
Not all at once.
Thank you. Thanks, Roy.
Thank you.
Joe?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to this. I'll have a look at that thing.
Yeah. Drop it down.
Thank you. general. Will you guys be able to give us an update just as you Kevin and Stan says, huh?
You can ask
the
questions, yeah?
I don't mind. I'll give you a little bit of an overview, if you don't mind. And then
just
take
quickly.
Any questions you have. Yeah?
Just quickly.
Yeah, so electrical, it's obviously a bit down on last year. It was at half year, and it continues to be so. It's very, very exposed to construction, unfortunately. They have diversified quite nicely into renewables. But even in some of those cases, like solar geysers, although they are moving, the big procurer of that is the Department of Energy. The issues there with the Department of Energy, so we've got some big orders, but they don't seem to have budget for it. So we do anticipate that business to come, but not in this financial year. Prepaid meters is another diversification that they went into, that they have received a couple of orders from City of Joburg, that's starting to pick up. And I think overall, Baltic remains a very, you know, it's by far the biggest, largest electrical wholesaler in the country with a big, extensive range of products. So relative to the construction industry, and to put it that way, and the infrastructure industry, which is Eskom, and Eskom's infrastructure rollout, which is zero, I think it's doing okay. But it is a bit down on last year.
I think maybe just to add on to what Lindsay has just said, what we're hoping is that in the new financial year there'll be an unlock. I mean, on the metering side, they've just been awarded almost 100,000 meters for Eskom. But the problem with government is implementation. So the issue around procuring and getting the orders, that's not where the problem is. It's getting the product out into the areas where it needs to be. So we're hoping that'll kind of unblock in the next financial year. And that's a significant portion of your business.
Is that metering business an annuity type business? Is it a service business, almost like with
no,
the phone?
So you sell them the thing.
Okay.
We do sell prepaid electricity, though, but we haven't done a very good job with that. But that's something we need to pick up on. That would then become annuity based. So we do have a Baltic app where you could buy prepaid electricity for certain municipalities. But it's not something that's in its infancy, really. It's something we would like to pick up on. So it's a natural. I think the country's going to move more and more towards prepaid. And we need to plan that. We're going to sell the meters. We need to plan that in the selling of electricity as well. But to give you an example of these rollouts, and I don't want to dwell on it for too long, we've had something like 25,000 solar geysers ordered, paid for by government, that are sitting in warehouses and they pay us to store them because they can't decide on the rollout implementation of where these geysers should go. And we're just one of eight companies, so there's probably 100,000 geysers out there sitting in storage facilities. They pay the storage rate. But you know, the poor resident who should be getting hot water in a rural area somewhere is sitting without a geyser on the roof. And I think it was hinted at earlier by Alan, you know, these rollouts by government departments, unfortunately, is problematic at the moment. There are too many acting CEOs. We had a very, we have a lot to tell us in the middle of it. I was going to tell a joke. About our meeting yesterday.
Yeah, no, don't do that.
So that's electrical. I think when infrastructure comes back, I mean, we really are well geared and well placed with it. We scaled back, we're closing branches, we're doing what everybody else is doing. But it is, and it's our smallest division, thank goodness. Quite significantly our smallest division. So even though it is hurting a bit, it doesn't damage the group as such too dramatically. Office and print division continues to do remarkably nicely and well. We saw they were up at half year and they remain up. We did quite an interesting exercise because of the diversification of our businesses. About 45% of their customers are actually the retailers. So one might think that that's a negative, but we actually supply them with, we don't supply them a product for resale, we supply them a product that they need to use in their facilities. We print a lot of their stuff, either electronically, whatever. So when we met with our friend from TFG at a conference at Sun City, he had done an exercise on how much he spends with us, and he couldn't believe his financial director, who we had showed him what the spend with Bidvest was, because he knew he didn't buy anything from us to put into his stores to sell. So, yeah, the retail sector, even though Edcon's going through drama and game, etc., the back office and the infrastructure of what they're doing and their promotional activities is still very extensive. And that's where we're doing quite nicely, to be quite frank with you. And that's why Bidvest is unique, and it touches every single aspect of this country somewhere along the line, with agriculture or whatever. And in retail, even though we don't sell to them, 45% of Kevin's in print business is to the retail stores. They renewed the Konica Manalt, treasury contract. It had lower margins. And it's, do you want to touch on it? It's a complicated, it goes to too much detail. But it's lower margins, we've got to outsource it.
Yeah, so I mean, without going into too much detail, but the pricing model was changed in the tender, which effectively cut the margin by about 50%, actually. It's quite significant. And then on top of that, there's an SME. There's an SMME piece to it. So one of the requirements of the tender was that we outsource 30% of the contract by province. So we also only have 70% of the contract, so 30% is outsourced to small businesses. So that model has really, really fundamentally changed. They've been very slow in terms of implementation of the new contract. So even though it was renewed in January, we're still almost operating on the old terms, but the volumes are obviously lower as they're negotiating into the new contract. So I think we'll probably see the impact of that in the next financial year.
But it will bring with it a bit of a slowdown in the second 6 months for office and print. Because Konica Manalt is the biggest piece of that division's business. But the rest of the businesses are doing okay. We have decided to get out of, you asked about selling businesses, we have sold or closed selling the furniture seating business, because it's a business that had been stumbling along for too long. As Howard said, we looked at trying to fix it, redo it, reshackle it, didn't come to the right conclusion, we started reselling it. Alan, I may as well touch on that at the same time. In Alan's business, which he didn't mention, TMS, which was industrial services, we sold that business. It really didn't suit us. It was aimed at, it was really project, almost construction-driven type business for Eskom and the petrochemical businesses. It wasn't, we're not engineers. We're not really project management type company. So we sold that business. That happened about 2 months ago. And obviously when we come to Namibia, we'll tell you about the fishing businesses. So we do sometimes sell business.
On office and print, just to highlight that in the comparison, in the previous year, we had Bonke in there, which we don't have. So for them to be up is really significant, because Bonke made about... I can't give numbers, no?
No.
Oh.
The numbers, it was a big number.
It was okay. A big number.
Yeah.
But then for the first six last year?
Yeah.
And it's in for naught this year.
Yeah.
But notwithstanding that, that's all up for naught. So, I mean, we're very pleasantly surprised and pleased with our office and print, because we still do see it as one of those industries which is in subtle decline. They definitely print less stuff than they used to and sell less stationery. So we've had a lot, we've done a lot of work at Walton's, as an example. And it's been a tough, we've had quite a tough time getting that thing right. It was a big ship to fix, and they've come a hell of a long way in fixing it. So we're very happy about that. In their furniture division, they had capital projects. People have cut back on CapEx spend. This boardroom table has been here since Bidvest started here. This is probably 20 years old, and I don't think we're going to replace it too soon. So this is a Cecil Nurse type product. So they're having a bit of a tougher time of it. But overall, they run a very good shop, and they right size the business is probably the best way to describe the way that they managed to achieve. Like most of Bidvest, and when Mark gets to chat a little bit about his side of life, we'll tell you a little bit about our expense management and asset management side of life. Is there any other questions on office or on electrical?
Yeah, do you have a sense of if any more
more load shedding could be coming? I mean, some of the orders coming in on the electrical side. Is there any movement to see from that supply vehicle?
Yeah, we did. You know, when the load shedding hit 2 months ago, whatever it was, we sold a hell of a lot of inverters and generators and stuff, but people stop very quickly as soon as the power comes back on, you know. So a lot of people get caught with excess stock, and, you know, people got into a lot of trouble with generators about 4 years ago and inverters. So we do sell inverters, and we build and make generators.
So
the business that used to give us that kind of visibility is the one that we sold. TMS used to do maintenance work at Eskom. Based on their lack of, what's the terminology again? They would do maintenance, shutdown. So when we would then see that there's no shutdown for maintenance, because we would always have a schedule. You'd have a 3-year schedule that would say there should be a shutdown at Kusile on this date, a shutdown here. And then we could see it. So when that maintenance work was then not happening is when we would be able to see that something's going to happen at Kusile, something's going to happen at MCC, because they haven't done any maintenance for 12 months, 18 months. We don't have that visibility anymore because it's all that.
Who's next? Me.
You.
Me.
You.
All right, so I think then, as you guys, as we've so often said, I mean, this diversification. It's called the coffee machine. I think the diversification of Bidvest, we said this to you every single time, but it really is our strength. You heard today some very good stories, and you heard some tough stories, and you heard them every story. So you all saw our results for the first six. We thought they were reasonably decent. The next four, which we're really talking to today, have been tougher than those first six, without doubt. Leading up to the election, things really did get quite quiet. I have to be very frank about that. Our annuity-based business has continued to do well. We've continued to grow them, and even I think Ant sort of underplayed it a bit, but, you know, BTT really is doing exceptionally well as a result of the fact that we've invested in infrastructure there, and it's all annuity-based, take or pay from day one. And those sort of models have done well. Noonan is a really, really nice business, and obviously earning in foreign currencies. We're extremely pleased about the performance of that, which Alan did hint at. So overall, we have continued to, as we've said in the SENS announcement that I'm sure you've all got in front of you, overall, the year-to-date operating performance has been acceptable, but a bit off where we were. So I don't expect, I think, come June to see quite the same level of HEPS growth that we had before. Although I think when Mark touches on his section, our property division and our corporate office are a contributor to our performance. We don't talk too much about it, but we can give you some indications today, maybe under Mark's section when he talks about the corporate office. And it is quite a significant element to our business. Financial position, again, Mark will take you through it, remains very strong. Asset management is a massive focus area for us. Cash flow is a massive focus area for us. Our debt levels remain at about 1x EBITDA, notwithstanding, as you can see, quite a few bolt-on acquisitions. We've spent a lot on the LPG CapEx program, and notwithstanding that, the cash flow remains at about 1x, which we've indicated here. on the BE side, I think Jill is going to talk to you a little bit. I think we're making great strides there, which is very, very important in China. That's the fact that we are 95% a South African company. Just to get into some of the speciality areas, the delisting of Namibia is now done and dusted. We've got a 99% approval, so it's delisted, 99% of minorities accepted, and we'll just clean out the rest, yep. And the checks will be paid in the next week.
On Monday.
On Monday. So thanks to Ilza, she was very responsible for doing that. The disposal of Mumbai, which is about R1 billion worth of disposal, at a very healthy profit to us, which we haven't accounted for, which Mark touched on. And that corporate office type activity. It is taking longer than we originally thought. We knew we were in for a bit of a tough time. Our partner in India, a company called GBK, there's been quite a lot of publicity about this, is in serious financial trouble and needed to raise funding. We did sit with him and we offered to cooperate and do everything necessary, but he gave us the middle finger. So we went ahead and ran a process, and we have a very firm offer from a third party who is cooperating with us, but GDK does have a first right of refusal and is trying his absolute hardest to delay us from... He hasn't got the money to, as we speak, to pay us, so if he gives us the money, he can have our shares, because he's got that right. But in simple terms, he doesn't have the money, so he's trying to delay the process so that he can somehow try and find funding to buy us out. So it actually has gone to court, and the court is ruling, I think they're in a bit of a recession, provocation recession at the moment, but we should hear something in about a month's time.
Yeah, we hope so.
We hope so. But India is India. But what we can tell you is that we're very confident of concluding the transaction, and it won't be years away. It'll be, you know, within the next couple of months. I just want to touch up, come back to Acroc last. Comair, we own 28% of Comair. We have said that we would like to sell it. We haven't had much success in finding anyone who wants to buy it. There are limitations of international ownership of it. Eric Center suddenly retired the other day, as you may have seen. They've appointed joint CEOs. We're not that comfortable with what's going on there. So we have met with them, and we are going to go on the board as of imminently. That should be announced in the next day or two that I will be on their board. I think it's still a very well-run business, but we just were a little bit uncomfortable about some of the moves that were happening there. I'm sure, and I've met with the chairman and one of the guys, I'm sure there's nothing untoward there. Unfortunately, very sadly, Eric lost his wife to cancer 8 months ago, and they really just said to me that subsequent to that, he was never really the same again, and he decided to move on. But notwithstanding that, we are going to get a lot closer to it, and then see how we could strategically deal with that asset of ours. It's worth, 28% of its market cap is worth about $800 million, and we would much rather put $800 million in the bank than hold Comair shares, even though it is a very well-run business. When it comes to Adcock, we've announced as much as 3 years ago that this was a non-core asset, and we would like to attempt to sell it to new black entrants. And myself, Pumi, Patu, and everybody else, various, the rest of us, must have met with about 30 or 40 different suitors, but nobody has money for that size transaction in South Africa at all. In every single case just about, they would refer to the PRC. The PRC, as you know, owned 25% of it. They were fully exposed and could not lend any further money for the Adcock transaction. That people tried with the IDC, they tried with the banks, they tried with international funders, but ultimately nobody could come up with the money. Pumi and I sit on that board. We did decide to become a bit more active on that board, as you may have noticed. So Clifford Rapiri was retiring as chairman, and I then became the chairman. And then we've had an internal debate about our long-term strategy regarding Adcock. It is a very, very well-run company. There's some really nice opportunities, acquisitive opportunities that they are looking at. And then a number of shares came onto the market, and we had a strategic discussion amongst ourselves, and we decided, together with the board and the acquisition committee, to acquire those shares. So you may have seen some announcements, or you, those of you who follow the share movement, that we bought about 600 shares, was it? Anyway, it took us up to 43%, which I think there was a SENS announcement yesterday by Adcock. Took us up to 43%. There is a BE transaction in Adcock, which will unwind at the end of July, 31st July. And when it unwinds, all the shareholders get their shares back because it didn't reach the expected price of 72 Rand. And we will get another 6% back.
6.5%.
So we'll be at 49.8%, whatever it comes to. So it's very likely that we will have to, armed as the chairman, we own 49.8%. We buy another 1 or 2%, we would then, it would become a bit of a subsidiary. So that, I'm not sure if we have to announce it, but that is really effectively what is probably going to happen. For this financial year, it remains an associate, because we don't have any voting rights on those BE shares. The fact that I'm only going to be the chairman from the 1st of July, so I guess when we next speak to you guys in August, we'll be able to give you certainty on what our final decision is. But I think strategically, if we do that, effectively we would have, at no premium, we would have moved from what was 38% to maybe 51% and paid no premium, which I think would be a smart business move. We would then also, if one day we could potentially keep this asset for a period of time, we really do not need the cash at this stage. We've got a very low level of debt. It's a great company. We've consolidated the results. It's not going to have a big impact on HEPS, obviously, because we're really counting for it from an associate perspective, other than the additional shares. And then we'll take it from there. So it is a change in strategy. I'm happy to take questions. But it's a very, very good asset. We do understand it very much better these days. And I think it will be more healthy to have a 51% controlling stake in the business. It becomes a proudly Bidvest business with us chairing and controlling the board, as one would with any other subsidiary, and then us take a strategic decision over a period of the next couple of years as to what we want to do with it.
Lindsay, was there something that, I don't know if you can answer this, but the PIC was sort of not allowing you to do so. If you had an idea to improve your business, that the PIC was sort of, yeah, just that, what does that control bring to?
Well, we're a little puzzled about the PIC, to be quite honest, because they purposely went to 25.1%, and so they had a blocking vote for any special resolution. So not that we wanted to unbundle, but they were always concerned we might sell it to an international pharma company or whatever, and they may want, you know, somebody else may want to close it down and do all the manufacturing offshore. And they were concerned about that. But the PIC it doesn't really seem to know what they want to do these days. I can't really answer for them. But we have no agreements with them that we can't do whatever we want to do. They
could sell it internationally once you control it. There's nothing stopping you selling it to an international player.
And we think it's a match to nothing. And I think that would be a much better asset to sell than 38% of the company. And in fact, with a nice control premium, if you think it through it. And we got to this control premium without having to pay again.
So it was
sort of fell into our laps almost, in that this massive parcel of shares came up and we grabbed it. And that the BE scheme failed. That's a bit unfortunate, obviously, because it's not good when the East can fail, but nothing we could really do about it. It was just priced at the wrong price. Because the Adcock BE scheme, not our scheme.
There's another BE scheme that you put in place in July.
No. Look, it's a good company, Adcock. You know, it recently won the ARB tender. They were the biggest beneficiary of the ARB tender, which kicks in July. They've made some decent consumer-type acquisition, which gets you away from the price control issues. They've got a good management team. There's a couple of nice acquisitions. A few men are sitting on the acquisition committee there. There's a couple of nice deals that they're looking at. Nothing to be announced yet, but so contract that would really be beneficial, accretive to them. So we'll I think we're going to move to over 50% and make it into a bit less subsidiary at no premium.
25.
What is the excess? No, there was an ad hoc since announcement that said they dropped to 18.55.
Which we find strange, and that's why I don't want to talk to the PRC. But strategically, they kept the 25 for whatever reason, but now they're selling, you know, and it's kind of.
Would you consider going more than 51?
Good, if the price was right, you know. It's a matter of price. I think we go to the 51 based on control. We don't really need to go much more than that. I think, you know, and I don't want to give the wrong impression. Our long-term strategy on Adcock, we're going to have to reevaluate once we get to 51. So maybe at our next board meeting or next presentation to you guys in August, we'll be able to give a little bit more clarity, because by then it would have all transpired.
So maybe if I can just add on to what Lindsay was saying, I mean, the trigger is 3 years of being unable to sell an asset. It's $5 billion. That's what our investment is there. What do we do? Do we sit for another 3 years and wait? Or do we do something significant and become a proper player and manage the business? Decide then what to do with the asset when you've got a more chunkier piece to take to market, potentially. That's what we decide to do.
Yeah.
Did you monitor the cash flows all coming out of that business?
Very good. Not really, man.
No,
I'd have to check.
Oh, okay.
I do have a very, very good cash flow. So they've got no debt?
Debt level is very, very low. So it would enhance our position if you bought that over the balance sheet from a debt point.
Okay.
No. Lindsay, what is that ALV contract to capacity utilization? Where is utilization currently?
So
in terms of ARP?
Not sure. This is a separate listed entity. So to ask operational comments from us and to comment on utilization rates, I'm not sure that's appropriate.
Fair comment, sorry. I wasn't going
to answer. I was my fingers. That's 3 months' time.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go. Because I knew the answer. All right. Just interesting on Comair, because we did have a bit of a discussion with him. You know, it is pregnant with the SA claim. Everybody's concerned, and that's about $1.6 billion. Everyone's concerned about that, with SA will ever pay them. The first tranche of $360 million was paid. And from, I think, sometime in July, it's all public information, they're going to pay $50 million a month. There is some concern about that, but it would... With it might come some big opportunities for Comair. Hence, we're going to sit on Comair for a bit as well. Get on that board, really get to understand it a little bit better and see what the longer-term strategy is there. I think, again, one must be careful not to be critical, but clearly we all understand that SAA is not in great shape. I see they announced this morning the general manager ops is now acting CEO. So, you know, I think something's going to happen at the end of the day. And I think Bidvest might be in a position not to buy a Comair. We definitely won't buy a Comair, but maybe just to take advantage of a good price on that asset. Because it's at a very low PE here. Even though it's pregnant with, it's on about a 5 PE or something like that. And it's pregnant with this massive claim, et cetera, et cetera. So I think patience in that one is a virtue. And I'm sure we will carry on with it.
Perhaps you can go back, and not to pick at a... But for the benefit of hindsight, and going back to the time that the Adcock stake was acquired, it just seemed very out of character for the type of acquisition that, you know, Bidvest does, both in size, the fact that it's listed. I'm interested to understand the thought process that went into that acquisition relative to the process now. And whether or not that type of acquisition can happen again.
You know, the biggest lesson we learned about buying Adcock was to be very wary of buying a listed entity, particularly in a hostile takeover fight, where you no due diligence. Because the problem with ADCO, of course, is that we paid a particular price, which I think is common knowledge, and what we found once we bought it was not what we thought was there. So we often debate that. I think it was you talked about someone who's selling a fleet management business, you know. To even contemplate buying the top one of that one, you know, which is listed without due diligence, is a lesson we've learned. We'll never do that again. Well, I definitely won't, and I'm sure my darling here would definitely won't either. We wouldn't buy listed companies or any company without proper DD. Because that was the real problem with ADCOC. If we have been allowed to do a DD, I can assure you that Mr. Joffe and Brian never paid that price. But now it's fixed. Now it's properly fixed. We do think we would like to bit westernize it just a bit more. I think Kevin went in there and...
I should have bought Kevin today. He answered all the questions.
He's forgotten what it's like.
I just sort of put my glasses on. Yeah, no, it is. It's a really good business. Great cash flows. Good market share. It's about 20% of the entire pharma product range in any pharmacy. And that's without the ALBs, without the critical care drips and all the rest. But just in any pharmacy, 20% of every product comes from ADCO.
Is there anybody but best related in at the moment? Because Kevin's out now, but you don't have any of your...
No, but without... We haven't decided, but obviously if we make a subsidy, it has to fit in somewhere. So you know, like King Five fits in well into services. It'll fit in well somewhere.
I'm not going to put on my glasses.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah, well, you're bad guy, like it. That's for next time. Once it becomes we go that route, we'll explain what you're going to do. I think I've covered most of my issues, unless anybody wants to answer any...
Any financial questions for Mark?
Maybe Mark can just touch on properties, corporate office, some of our venture capital stuff like Alice and SAT, just to give you an idea that we do have other innovative stuff in Bidvest.
Okay, Lindsay, thank you. So within our corporate head office, if you like, there are a number of different entities. We have a big property portfolio. I think we specified to you at half year and at last year, and it's got a book value of somewhere around $3 billion. We think the market value of that asset is about $7 billion. It's principally Bidvest companies within that portfolio. It's really, really well managed. Profitability levels, the yields are very good. We've got a vacancy rate at somewhere below 2% at the moment. So very comfortable with that asset, and it's been growing nicely through the year. So a big chunk of the capex that's gone in for the group as a whole has gone into that particular asset. Very happy with it, and gearing levels very acceptable on it. So very happy with where the properties is sitting. The sort of special projects, if I can use that term that Lindsay's referring to, Alice is one I think that we are very proud of. It's sitting quietly in the back of our scores. It came out of our internal audit department, and essentially it's an internal auditing software solution. It's very innovative. It grew in the Bidvest environment because we had difficulty in, for example, trying to bridge common auditing standards across businesses that are massively disparate. So you had a scenario where you try to put an internal audit solution into services versus a freight versus a BCP, very, very different environments. And they managed to create an AI software solution in there, which is by far and away incredibly innovative. It's now being deployed into about 5 or 6 large corporates within SA on a beta basis. It has been running in those environments for more than a year. It's gaining an enormous amount of traction. It's something we're talking to offshore players about, just in terms of trying to gain skill set to be able to grow this particular product. We haven't significantly monetized it, although it has been monetized. At the moment, it's at a break-even level, and we'll see what that brings. We're very, very excited about that particular one. And then, quietly also in the background, there is a medical venture capital operation, if you like. It's been done in conjunction with Curtis Skier, with the Chris Barnard Heart Center. It's been ongoing now for the better part of about 5 or 6 years. We went in initially as a capital provider, sitting quietly in the background. The particular product that they're involved in is heart valves, and two components of it. One is the development of special new heart valves, and the other one is a deployment, a completely innovative deployment mechanism which allows you to replace the heart valve without opening up the chest. It's incredible technology. So they have something where they use what they call non-occlusive operating procedures. So essentially you can go in via the groin, replace the heart valve and come back out, and you don't have to cut open the chest. Incredible, and really the focus there is on third world, where you don't have operating theatre capacity to be able to do that type of operation. And why we're so excited about it right now, obviously it's gone through quite a long process, is that we have gone through two first-in-man processes. So what first-in-man is, for no one who's familiar with it, is essentially you have to do a medical procedure for the first time in the world anywhere, and it has to be successful. So the patient has to live, which is really where you're at. Okay. We've done two so far. Both were successful. Once you're beyond between 8 to 10 processes, suddenly, obviously, then the value of that particular technology scales incrementally. So we're very excited about that. We continue to fund it. Obviously, the funding costs, as you get closer to a point where you're actually now going to monetize it, significantly increased, because now you're testing on a much more globular scale. But we're very excited to see where that's going to go. It's been in the press quite a lot of late. They've got a number of significant international awards for innovation. So the next big Chris Barnard story is going to come out of this one. But from a value point of view, you're not going to see anything on the balance sheet. There's nothing massive there. We've written off everything that we've put into it to date and continue to do so. So look forward to hopefully bringing something to the market that will be very, very different. And then just generally, income statement, and I'll be super quick. Trading of both growth and trading margins have been maintained, and in fact slightly improved for the 10 months to date. Trading profit remains up, although the growth rate has slowed, because we've already specified that. Our interest line has been under a little bit of pressure, so it is upwards, was flat at half year, but not significantly so, driven mainly by working capital investment at the moment. You may recall that we had quite a big outflow of working capital at half year. I'm pleased that's come back quite a lot, certainly to the 10 months now. I'm expecting it to come back more through to June, but it won't be at the levels that we saw last year. Last year we had a massive inflow of, I think, $1.5 billion for the group. I don't think we're going to get anywhere close to that, but it certainly will be significantly better than where we are now. And so the guys are tracing very hard. Catherine, to your question, working capital and particularly stock at the moment, they're working very hard. The stock have increased. The quality of stock we think we're comfortable with. Our provisioning levels are at the right level. Debtors book is being well managed, although aging has pushed out. We haven't seen significant impairments. So obviously the teams are monitoring that very closely. And particularly, you know, the guys are quite conservative in terms of taking credit cover through CGIC, et cetera. But touch wood so far, no massive losses in the book. But the real area on the working capital where we've seen a flow is on trade creditors. I think we'll see an improvement in that to year end, but again, it won't be at the level to where we were. So if you recall, I think we were north of $3 billion outflow just in relation to credit to trade creditors at half year. That's dropped to below $2 billion now at the end of end of 10 months. So it's come back nicely, and let's see where we end up for June. Otherwise, on the balance sheet, no significant moves on fixed assets. It's been the normal capex in freight, which Anthony talked about, mainly LPG. There's been a little bit in properties. On the acquisition front, McGlinsey's talked to it, lots of little bolt-ons. And those are all nicely positive. We'll just carry on ticking those over as they're our bread and butter. Two biggish acquisitions that we're in process with now, one locally and one in Europe. The one in Europe, we're into the second round of that one, so we'll see where it comes. It's a nice looking business. The disposals, again, it's really been clean up across a number of the divisions. Happy to take questions on the rest.
One question on the new leases standards.
Yes.
With the transfers and freight and everything.
Yep.
Is it going to affect your bottom line at all, or is it just a reallocation between
depreciation? So we've been through quite an extensive exercise. As you can imagine, there are a number of leases across the group. So if I talk just the income statement, firstly, it will be a trading profit, slightly enhancing, okay? But at a HEPS level, it will be negative. Because essentially what's happening at the top line is you've got depreciation coming in at a lower level than the rental that you're taking out, but the interest line is where you get hit. So it will be slightly negative at a HEPS line. We've done all the calcs. We know what the numbers are going to be. You'll see them all in August. But balance sheet side, significant impact, but you've almost got a match between obviously whatever comes on the asset side versus the liability. It's going to make our balance sheet look very different though for next year. But I think that's same for all the large corporates with the leases. So what's going to go up by? And I'll tell you in 3-2 months time. But it'll be a number. But you've got a matching asset on the other side.
It doesn't affect how your debt finances. They've always looked at these leases. That doesn't change that at all.
Well, they're going to have to do. I mean, from a covenant point of view, it doesn't affect us. I'm sure it will affect some people, but it doesn't affect us. But I think banks and other financial institutions have to start looking at balance sheets differently. IFRS has taken us into a new space, to be fair.
Touch on the bond raising exercise you guys did last week, was it
too early? No, that's next week. I'm happy to talk to it. You mean overseas in London?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. So, maybe two components just from a funding point of view and to pick up Lindsay's forward looking process. So, locally, we are in process right now. We're going to do a little bit of a bond raise next week. We're looking to raise between one and a quarter billion, depending on what the rates are like. The intention there really is just to refi a bond of $1.5 billion, which is due 3rd of July.
Rand.
No, I said local. It can only be rand.
I haven't got
to the offshore side yet. What Lindsay was alluding to. So we had a team that went over last week to the UK. Just to get a sense of what funding rates and capital availability is like in UK, Europe at the moment, because one of the acquisitions we're looking at is based there. And we're very pleasantly surprised by what we came back with. Just to give you some comparisons, 2 years ago we raised 200 million euros for the Noonan and USS acquisitions. We funded those at 180 basis points over the 3-month Euribor. The Euribor, as everyone knows, is negative. And coming out of last week, firm offers at 140 basis points over Euribor. And the guys came back, and one of the big banks came back to them on Monday and said, we'll give you 135 basis points. So, I mean, there's 45 basis points there just to refinance the debt structures offshore. Without any acquisitions, etc. So we're going to go through a process now by consolidating the one acquisition we're doing, plus the other debt we've got there, and lowering our overall borrowing rates in Europe. So I think that's very positive.
Is there capacity for more debt?
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the shape of what they'll lend you at those rates.
Absolutely, capacity. I mean, in fact, there's a hunger for it.
Relative to what you've got outstanding at the moment, what tell us what they're willing to do or not.
Sorry, relative to
what you've got outstanding at the moment, can you tell us what they're willing to do?
Well, I mean, so we were talking into a range up to half a million euros. That's the sort of range we were looking at, just because what it does is you're taking your 200, you're adding some acquisitive, you're consolidating other debt, etc. That's what we were looking at, and those are the funding rates we got with that sort of indication. We didn't take it any further than that. There's nothing on the table at the moment that would require us to.
But previously we had tested the market, and they were quite comfortable on our balance sheet up to $1 billion.
Yeah.
It was about 2 years ago.
Yes, correct.
We just wanted to get a feel because we were looking at a significant acquisition at the time overseas, and they were comfortable at $1 billion. And our balance sheet's a lot stronger.
Absolutely.
Since then.
Other questions?
Aside from my side, I'm happy to take questions. Just from a BE point of view, as you know, it's obviously a very significant role for us in business. And it's not just in government space, it's actually predominantly in the private sector. From a compliance and a scorecard point of view, I mean, that's our entry point into any business contract or tender. We're very happy with that. A lot of our businesses are sitting at level 1 and 2. You know, those that work 3 that move to 1. So just from that measurement criteria, we're doing really well. Some of the companies that we acquired in like the last 2 years have really also come to the party. You know, they came on board with kind of poorer ratings, but we've really put the pressure on to make sure that they are up to scratch as far as the rest of our businesses are concerned. And we always have the message to say that that should never be a reason why we never win anything or able to get business. So from that perspective, it's really good. We do have challenges, though, with some of our bigger suppliers. And then I talk about suppliers, I'm talking predominantly about the multinationals and the inability or maybe lack of willingness to transform. So their BE credentials are fairly poor. We're constantly engaging with the various forums and DTI, but unfortunately doesn't seem to do really well. So all we have to do then is really focus on the areas that we can control. Just in a space from a customer point of view, we're finding, and we work this in Pumisi, specifically in the space that she's in as well, is we find ourselves in a position where we're starting to have stronger, I suppose, partnerships with our clients in finding solutions that will help them from the supply chain point of view, but it also helps us in terms of gaining business from them. So it helps us, especially because we do have very good relationships with our customers, and it helps them as well because they also can't do it on their own, and they're really looking for help to introduce particularly black-owned businesses and SMEs into the supply chain. So we're finding that that's quite helpful. We are introducing SME models where it works well. It helps because it then enables us to replicate those types of models in other areas where it's appropriate. Other than that, sometimes, yes, the challenges of the goalpost changing, I mean, that doesn't seem to stop. You know, there's been some new amendments that came out a couple of days ago, again by the DPI. I still have to get my head around those. But, yeah, we just have to work with what we have, and we still always just do what's good for our business. So
thank you very much for your attendance today. We appreciate your time, and we hope that you learned something new about the group today.
Thank you.